So he needs
indeed,
that marketing.
Indeed.
Yeah, sorry, I had a rant. It's mostly your rant.
No,
not
it's good. It's I think you said it very well, right?
Welcome to episode 215 of the Rockstar CMO FE Marketing Podcast. It's Saturday, 27th of April. I hope you've had a good week and you're staying as sane as you feel you need to be. I'm your host, Ian Truscott. I'm not a rockstar, but I am a CMO and trusted marketing advisor. And on this podcast, with the help of my chums, we share marketing street knowledge to inspire your inner rockstar. Come say hello. You can find links to me and my guests in the show notes at rockstarcmo.com or on LinkedIn at rockstarcmo, and we are proud members of the Marketing Podcast Network. My normal studio sidekick, Jeff, is still away for a couple more weeks, and so I'm going to continue as a solo act, sharing five thoughts for the week. But of course, I'm not completely alone, as in the Rockstar CMO virtual bar, Robert Rose has some thoughts about Musk versus the marketing. But first, we need to pay the bar tab. I'll be back in a moment.
We'll be right back.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Right, let's get this show started. Five effing thoughts from me, inspired by my week. So here we go, my second go at sharing five effing marketing thoughts of the week. I was going to talk about the marketing topic of the week, which is, of course, Elon firing his marketing team at Tesla. But as you'll hear, Robert and I go into a bit of a rant about that in the virtual bar, which I recorded with him last night. So we'll come on to that. But I do have five thoughts. And my first thought is about marketing teams and moves. So similar kind of thing. And it's this idea of right fit marketers. So lately with my clients, I've been having conversations about high growth and startups and the people that are needed at each phase. And of course, the truth is, as a business needs change, as a business grows, it needs different kinds of people and skills at different stages during that growth. And not just in marketing, of course, but in sales and product development. And I'm having these conversations with a couple of companies that are sort of in these different phases. And there's two things that have popped up in these conversations. The first, if you're in this situation as a marketer, you need to be ready to adapt and change and grow with the company and keep a close eye on what the company needs today. But most importantly, perhaps actually, is what it's going to need next. And also have a bit of a think about if that's right for you. So if you can see that your company is growing and you're hiring more people into the team, and maybe you're going to need to take on different responsibilities, become more of a manager than a practitioner, is that what you want to do? And is it time that you sort of either change your skills and adapted, or maybe had a conversation with your manager about what's best for you and where you want to go? Because your business is going to change, the marketing team is going to change around you. Secondly, if you are a leader, you need to make sure that your team are being developed, but also do that check-in that I just discussed from the marketer's perspective, that they're in for the ride. Some folks just like working for small companies, startups, and some people like to be generous and like, you know, to be focused on growth across a whole bunch of different disciplines within marketing. And normally, if you're growing your marketing team, that means moving people into bigger teams with specialists rather than generalists. So you'll create a demand team or a content team. Are these do your team want to do that? Are they up for that? Or do they like being doing little bits of everything in that kind of startup mode? And are they committed to the change that's coming? Do you need to coach them, or maybe have some honest conversations, as I mentioned, about the changes that happen to growing companies from your experience that you've seen? Also, as a leader, you need to look at your own skills and passions. A CMO, a large organization, has to be more politician, internal champion of marketing, and less of a hands-on marketer. So weirdly enough, if you want the big CMO job, you might end up actually doing less marketing. And if the marketing's a thing you love, then maybe you need to think about that. You might get the big bucks at a big company, but is that going to motivate you and get you excited every morning to do all that sort of politician stuff and that internal champion of marketing? Or is it the actually doing the marketing that really gets you fired up? So some advice I once received when I was in a high growth company, and this sort of applies to marketing leaders that are setting up their marketing function within, say, like a startup or a growth company, is as you plan and lay the foundations for what the next phase is going to be, say like you're scaling from 20 people to 200 people, is to think like the company you want to be. a bit like it's that Gandhi expression, isn't it? Be the change you wish to see, which is that you need to create the all of the structure, if you like, of that 200 person company, and think about what is it you're going to need at that point. And I don't mean implementing all the politics, bureaucracy, and the bollocks of a big company. I'm really thinking about planning, strategy, processes, and systems, as it's much easier to build great foundations before you have 199 people standing all over them than it will be later on. So it'll happen, and some of those things might happen sooner than you think. So if you're not thinking about tomorrow and what you need in terms of process and technology, you'll be trying to solve that problem as it happens. You know, it's that old phrase of building a plane while it's flying. It might be easier to do that as it takes off than rather than when you're at 35,000 feet and everybody's depending on you. Which moves me on to my second thought, which is also about marketing roles. And so while I was researching something else for these five effing thoughts, I came across a post on the Forrester blog about a new term they seem to be championing in their CMO advisory practice. They're referring to this topic of frontline marketing. And they define it as follows. Frontline marketing is Forrester's term that encapsulates the B2B marketing teams responsible for buyer audience engagement and most accountable to pipeline and revenue outcomes. I don't know what that means, because that sounds like utter nonsense to me. What other types of B2E marketing are there? If you look at the way they're defining this frontline marketing thing, they're responsible for buyer audience engagement, okay, and are accountable to pipeline and revenue outcomes. Aren't we all responsible for pipeline and revenue outcomes? So I'm not sure whether this frontline marketing thing should be a thing. And they also mate it to their other term, lifecycle revenue marketing. And the author of the blog post that I stumbled upon claims the need for frontline marketing because for this other term they're using called lifecycle revenue marketing. And they say the lifecycle revenue marketing is not executed by one team or leader, but rather by a coalition of frontline marketing functions working together to break through silos and achieve revenue growth together. Again, I'm not sure about this. Is this another one of those trends like agile marketing with a big A that is just good B2B marketing? Are either of these terms really necessary? For example, the author goes on to say, while technology and tactics play a role, unifying frontline marketing around the customer lifecycle and adopting a holistic, customer-obsessed and frontline strategy, i.e. lifecycle revenue marketing, will be a key driver for future growth in modern B2B organizations. And again, all of that, those buzzwords just sound to me like marketing. I'll include a link to that post in the show notes. As you know, I'm normally quite a fan of the works of Forrester, but this feels a bit bullshitty to me. I'd love to know what you think. Are we again making things too complicated? Or maybe is frontline marketing going to be a thing? Let me know. See what you think. So on the topic of the continuing topic of what it is that we do as marketers, my third thought is about buying tribes. And it kind of linked to my last thought because it's something that's been knocking around in my head for a bit. It's probably inspired by something I heard on the Forrester podcast a couple of months ago, as they do good stuff. I quite like their work. But last week, I chatted about prospects filling in forms, and I touched on the idea there are different types of intent. When somebody fills in the form. So some people want their intent with filling in the form is to get educated. They're trying to understand the market or the category, or they want to know a bit more about the topic that you're talking about. They're not necessarily in a position to buy. Their intent is to get educated. And then there's those others, of course, who have the intent to buy. So they're filling in their form because they're interested in you and they'd like you to call them and they'd like you to offer them your solution. And it's hard for us to discern between those two things when, as marketers, when those form fills are done, as both motions are important to serve as for us as marketers. For us as marketers, I know that sales only care about the people that have the intent to buy, but for us, the intent, the people that have the intent to be educated are also important because they're high level, top of funnel kind of people that we want to get engaged, and they may influence an opportunity. They may spread the news about us, or they may actually become a buyer themselves. But it is quite complicated for us if you're in an organization that, you know, where attribution is very important, to understand true pipeline and attribution and what it is that marketing's contribution to that is. But anyway, I've digressed a little bit there with going down that attribution rat hole. But what I was thinking about, when I was thinking about some more about this, is specifically for this book that I'm trying to write. And I started to think of the people involved in a B2B procurement as a group of hunters roaming the B2B buying savanna of your category, looking for a solution to their problem. And this group is made up of different kinds of hunters, depending on what they're looking for. You have the scouts like meerkats popping their heads up, sniffing at what's new and different in the market and prepared to do the early discovery work for the rest of the tribe. Maybe they're early adopters or the sponsors of change that every B2B buying decision needs. So you need people within an organization who want to make a change. Otherwise, they're not going to buy anything new, right? And it's those people that are probably those people that whose intent right now is to be educated. They're looking at what's new, what's different, what are other people doing, what's this case study? Let me have a look at that and see if there's some change that I need to bring back to my organization. Then they're the primary hunters, those that have identified the problem or maybe been alerted to the problem by these meerkats, these scouts, these horizon scanners. And then they are actively seeking and tracking down a solution to the problem. So they're proactively hunting for a solution. Their intent is to buy, or at least their intent is to form a shortlist and maybe at some point buy. And then you have the person in the tribe that does the final processing of the prey. Now, I'm not sure where to go with this analogy, but I'm thinking about the person in the tribe who actually brings the what's been hunted home, right? Are they the butchers, do you think? The people who actually do the procurement and the buying. So in the B2B world, these are the procurement folks. These are people that are probably going to lead the project for that initial part, the implementation, the pilot and all that kind of stuff. And they're bringing the solution back to the tribe to implement it. So I'm thinking about these sort of three different audiences that we have, these scouts, these primary hunters, and maybe these butchers. I think I need to think more about that analogy. But it's important for us as marketers to not only realize that we have to provide different content for these different roles, but these different roles are, of course, different people within a buying group. And I think that's what we talk about a lot now in B2B, isn't it? It's not about individuals. It's now about buying groups. It's about the opportunity. And that's why the whole MQL thing falls down, because typically leads are individual people, whereas we need to think about these groups of people. And I wondered if this kind of this idea of this sort of group of hunters may be the way to go there. So that's my, what was that? Third thought, right? So the next thought is something that I shared actually in my Tuesday 2 Cents series, which is on my blog or on LinkedIn, which is about when we're looking at that sort of hunting group, is that we need to be distinct and we need to be different. Now, I've talked a lot about differentiation, you know, both on the blog and probably on here as well. And I don't think And we're all striving for differentiation as B2B marketers, and we tend to look at the products for that differentiation. But I think what we need to really think about is distinctiveness. So, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. But differentiation obviously is a popular topic for us, especially in a crowded category where a buyer needs to spend some time with you to discover those little differences between your product and the competition. Right. So it may not be immediately obvious why you're a better fit for this buyer. And it may be that they need to have a chat with you to figure that out. But the buyer doesn't have that time on that initial kind of look around the market. And I don't mean all this attention span of a goldfish bollocks, or they're distracted by their nan's Facebook page. What I mean is they can't possibly analyze every option available any depth in their first pass of the market when they're in top of funnel, right? When they're in this education phase, when they're just looking around the market. And our job as marketers is to help the buyer choose, right? And so we're trying to make it easier for them to find what's the choice. And I talk about this in the blog post as well. It's like, I'm quite keen on a fast no. If somebody's not for us, let's figure it out as soon as we can so we don't waste any marketing and sales motion on that prospect if it's going to be a poor fit down the road. But I'll talk about that some more another time. But it might be that your product, your flippers and flappers, may be the best, the most unique, leading and innovative. But right now, we need to earn the right to show them that, because that's going to take some time. And the cruel irony is that the more you try and differentiate your product in your on your marketing, on your website, the less different you look, especially in B2B. I mean, that's the classic thing in B2B, isn't it? Is all of the competitors look the same. They all say the same things. And that's really hard for the buyer. And also, a lot of what happens in B2B is everybody copies each other, or they copy the analyst, or they copy something that's happening. And it's a sea of grayness, isn't it? And as soon as a new idea pops into the category, everybody jumps on the wagon and talks about the same language, even if technically the product is not a great fit. So, for example, there was a trend in the content management world of headless. Then suddenly everybody was talking about headless, even those solutions that weren't necessarily technically headless. They had a story about it. And therefore, you know, and that's the great thing we do about marketing, right? We use all those mealy words and we completely confuse the buyer. And I think if you try to then argue with that position, oh, no, we're true headless. No, we're not. It sounds like a scene from Monty Python to me, and this might date me a little bit, if you know the scene where it says, the people's front of headless, fuck off, we're the headless people's front. All right, maybe they didn't say headless, but you understand what I'm saying is those subtle differences in language, the buyer's not going to really understand that. And it's their job to choose, and they can't see the difference. So in some cases, product differentiation in B2B is tricky unless you are very different, not just a little bit different. Plus, being different has its challenges. If you stray too far with a very differently positioned product or proposition, you may kind of leave the category that the buyer was looking at, right? And you've left the market because they're not seeing you as being the same as a group of other products that they can compare you with, right? So it's harder for you and your buyers to then find each other because you've left the category. So you need competitors to make a category in the market. So you all need each other. But amongst them, you need to be distinct, which the dictionary defines as the characteristic of one person or thing, and so serving to distinguish it from others, or the characteristic, I said, it's the singular, not the plural. But there you can see, so it's serving to distinguish it from others. And this is what we got to do as marketers, right? Is to figure out those things that can distinguish it from others. I'd also add, it needs to be immediately obvious as well. So that distinctiveness needs to be immediately obvious. And it's similar to when we discuss brand, right? Because this distinctiveness is in the eye of the buyer, not something we can fully control. So it might be that the buyer already, I mean, because people love to put things in boxes, right? So it may be they've already defined those distinctive attributes for themselves for you. So you might be the red logo people, or the big complicated solution, or the geeky ones. They've already got some shorthand that they describe your brand and your distinctiveness. So have a think about what is truly distinct about your company or product, or what you can say that's different. Now, also bear in mind, and I think I've talked about this before, that obviously, whatever you come up with, your competitors are going to be able to copy and move on. The difference is you have come up with this now and you've got the advantage of time, right? So today you're going to tell a new story into the market and it'll catch the imagination of the buyer and you can move forward. And I've actually heard about this on a podcast the other day, and I should have prepared this in the notes because I can't remember who to attribute it to. But how one of the key things about differentiation is actually how we communicate. So the way that our communications, how we talk, how the kinds of videos we produce, or the way that we approach social media, some of that may actually be in the may make us distinct. We may be saying very similar things to our competitors, but how we say them could be the thing that makes us distinct. So that's my thought about distinction. So have a think about what is truly distinct about your company. Is it the way you tell your story? Is it the story you're telling? Or is it how you communicate that story? And how is it that you're distinct from that? And that distinction is going to be the thing, like a little shining light, that the buyer will see and want to learn more about you. And that'll then give you that opportunity to share with them what's so different about your features and functions and flippers and flappers from your competitors that they never had time to figure out when they did that first pass of the market. So that's my fourth thought about distinction. My final thought, and it's a very quick one, is turn signals are for other people. Because yesterday I was out on my walk and I nearly got knocked over by a car as I was crossing the road as the driver didn't indicate or use their turn signal. They're on a roundabout. They zoomed in my direction and I had no idea they were coming because they didn't use their turn signal. I think turn signal is right in America. We call them indicators. And unfortunately, I'm not a mind reader. I had no idea they were coming. And I think I want to develop this idea that a lot of what we do and not what we need to remember as marketers is that we create content for other people, not for ourselves. So that person using their turn signal will prevent me from being knocked over. What do we create that helps our audience? We're not helping ourselves. So that's my five thoughts for the week. And as is our tradition on the show, I need to pick a song. So as I watched the new and very excellent Bob Marley movie last night, I'm going with So Much Things to Say by Bob Marley. A little bit of Bob Marley there, So Much Things to Say. You see what I did there? And as I say, I recommend the movie. And if you do want to chat about any of these topics or Bob Marley, give me a shout on LinkedIn. And if we're not connected, please let me know you're a listener of the show. Right, it's that time of the week to wind down in the Rockstar CMO virtual bar with someone I'm definitely connected with and join the Chief Troublemaker at the Content Advisory, Robert Rose, for a cocktail and a marketing thought. Good evening, Robert. What are you drinking?
Oh, hello, my friend, and welcome to the bar.
Thank you.
We have, it's, you know, it. I don't know, how is the weather there? Because it has been unseasonably wonderful here in Southern California.
Yeah.
Spring has sprung.
Yeah.
And so is it just gray and ugly and cold in the UK?
We've actually had some. We're a little cooler than we should be, but we have had a sunny day today. So I've enjoyed the sunshine
all right.
today.
Well, going into the weekend,
it
then,
feels springy. Absolutely.
Going into the weekend, excellent, excellent news. Well, we have something that is generally a summer drink, but I'm bringing it forward only because it's the end of the week and because. It was something that I really wanted, which is something I used to have all the time when I was growing up in Texas, but don't have a lot here. And it's what's called a Cadillac Margarita, which you've probably heard of.
Okay.
And the key with a Cadillac Margarita is the ingredients, because it is for all intents and purposes a classic. Margarita, but much more opulent, of course. So the key of the classic Cadillac Margarita is adding Grand Marnier in addition to your tequila. So the way I like to make them is you make a classic margarita. You have your 1.5 parts of I like a Blanco or a Reposado tequila here. And then, of course, you have your lemon juice and your lime juice, all freshly squeezed, because that's the way we do it here. We don't use mixes.
Nope.
And you can put in a little agave syrup if you like. I do not. Nope. You know, the agave syrup is the sweetener to make the margarita sweet. But I think the Cadillac margarita, then you just add your half part of Grand Marnier. And then, of course, you make it a salt rim. You put all that except obviously the salt into a shaker. Shake it all up and pour it nice and frothy into a cocktail glass with a salt rim, and you have a beautiful Cadillac margarita, very fancy margarita.
Yeah, I've never come across that. I bet that the Grand Marnier sounds delicious in that. I like that. Very nice. So we're sipping these Cadillac margaritas like the fancy folk we are. Where are we sipping these fancy cocktails this week?
Well, I think we have to go. So we're not in London, that's for sure. If it's going to be cold and rainy and gray, we're going to be somewhere where it's nice and sunny and warm. Mm-hmm. Which I think what we're going to do is we're going to head out to the desert.
Yes.
Because one of the best places to have a Cadillac margarita is where it's dry and warm, mm-hmm. and there's some heat going around. So I think we're going to head out to Palm Springs here,
nice.
Near my house, and sit out there underneath the mountains on a very warm spring day. Mm-hmm. And the key is that right now, since we're in mid-April, mm-hmm. we have the desert bloom going on. So the flowers out in the desert are just absolutely spectacular right now. And they are spectacular this year because of the rains that we've gotten here in Southern California. So we see fields and, you know, just rolling hills of bloomed flowers and a warm day and with some Cadillac margaritas.
It's I love it. We should just sit and chat and not talk about marketing. I think that sounds too nice. But should conversation turn to marketing? What's our thought this week?
Well, I think we have to rant a little bit. I think we have to have a little bit of a rant this week. Uh-huh. Maybe pour a couple of these Cadillac margaritas mm-hmm. back. Because, so I don't know if you heard, you probably did. Every marketing journal newspaper covered this, but Elon fired his marketing team this week from Tesla. Mm-hmm. And it's part of a larger layoff because, let's be honest, things are not going great at Tesla right now. No. And it's an interesting thing because when you look at it at its surface, you sort of go, how is this news, right? You know, mm-hmm. there's 140,000 employees of Tesla.
Yeah.
By all accounts, he's going to be laying off. The company is going to be laying off somewhere between 10 and 20% of its total mm-hmm. workforce, which means ultimately somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 20,000 people could lose their jobs.
Yeah.
And so when you look at it and say, okay, 40 people that made up what was called the marketing and content group, which for those of us who are inside marketing, we would know them better as sort of comms and PR mm-hmm. people rather than true marketing and advertising people, because that was what they did for years, was to handle social media, create content for videos and do branded content and that sort of thing. It didn't really work on classic marketing types of programs, but they started to. And so it was the news, the headline that most of the media companies are out there talking about is how this is a turnaround, right? Because mm-hmm. exactly a year ago, literally as Elon was tearing down the PR and comms teams out of Twitter, he basically begrudgingly said, okay, well, we'll do some advertising. So this team, this marketing and content team, and they called it a content design studio. Yeah. They've existed for at least 5 years, maybe even longer, but certainly 5 years in 2019, because that's how long the head of it, guy by the name of Alex Ingram, has been in charge of it. So it was a year ago that Elon said, well, we'll try some advertising. So this team was put in charge of making some advertising. And what's bothersome is not that he necessarily laid off 40 people as part of a broader group, mm-hmm. although there's certainly something to be said about how seriously Tesla takes any kind of marketing or branding when it has 40 people in marketing total of 140,000 person company. That aside, we'd say, okay, well, do we care? And the bothersome thing to me is that he went out of his way to tweet on X that the reason for this was because of the average work, quote unquote, this is him quoting now, or average work that the content and marketing team had done on advertising. Basically, he said it was basically like it could have been any car company, he said. Oh. So the bothersome part of that to me, and the ranty part, is really, you know, when you think about it, in the scheme of life, where you've got 10%, almost 15,000 of your employees going to get laid off over the course of the next year, mm-hmm. to go out of your way to throw the marketing team under the bus when clearly it's not their fault, the performance of the company, you know, the mm-hmm. fat, you know, DeLorean Cybertruck, you know, with all of its problems, lackluster sales, the problem with the EV market in general, his distraction of running a, you know, second tier social media platform as he tries to also run a car company, all of those problems. There's, you know, marketing and content and advertising was item number 763 on the things that are wrong with Tesla right now.
Yeah.
But to actually go out of his way and then throw those people under the bus by saying their work was average was just not only unnecessary, but to me, the most bothersome part of it is that when he did that with Twitter last year, almost a year ago, the sort of tech, you know, company CEO, you know, Illuminati, basically said, hey, this is probably an interesting thing to do. I see that he's tearing Twitter's down to its studs. Maybe we should do the same thing. And that's when it's one of the symptoms, I absolutely believe, of why we saw the tech layoff that we did in marketing and comms last year. And because everybody went, well, if Elon's doing it, we should do it too. We should see if we can do it as well. And I'm, you know, I'm afraid that the same thing's going to happen here. People are going to look at it and go, oh, he got rid of his marketing and comms content team.
Yeah.
Well, we should probably do that too. And the answer is no, you shouldn't. The marketing, branding, and content has never been anything other than an afterthought at Tesla.
Yeah.
And so the only lesson here is what not to do in marketing because there are so many other things wrong with that company. Yeah. Not having marketing is certainly one of the things that's wrong with them. Yeah. But there's no lesson to be learned here from Elon.
Absolutely. And I was going to have a rant about this, actually, at the beginning of the show, when because as I was chatting to you, you know, as you know, I've sort of changed the format of the show because it's just me at the beginning now. And I was going to rant about this as well, because I was also the same sort of thing, right? Why throw marketing under the bus? And, you know, there's so much of this discussion, isn't there, about the demise of the CMO, and this is just fuel for that stupid conversation. But the thing as well is I think this is a bad move for Tesla, because they're under so much competition pressure right now. Their chief evangelist is so Marmite that people are ashamed to own and buy Teslas, right? And I because now I'm working with a company who are in the EV charging space, so I know a bit more about the data around this. There are 40 different electric car models being going on the market in the UK this year, right? That is
amazing.
But that's the market for his company has changed significantly in the last 2 years, and no longer can it be only marketed by his persona, shall we just say, right? They, you know,
well, the that's the key. I mean, if
the long term damage,
it's a case study in real time, right? Which is he's been able to successfully make something uncool.
Yeah, I mean, you know. But even without that, I think let's take away the Musk effect. The evolution of that company in this category and this market is, in a year or two's time, when your brand activity that you do today is actually going to come home to roost. He needs to be doing that right now. I mean, Tesla had the opportunity, I think. I don't know. I mean, here in the UK, we call a vacuum cleaner a Hoover, and a Hoover is obviously a brand. And you know, you get those words
right.
Like that. Tesla could almost have been that. You know what I mean? The name for an electric car is a Tesla. You know, so, and if anybody thinks about electric cars, they think about Teslas. So they have this really magic moment, maybe a year or two ago, that seems to have gone away because of Musk's persona. But he needs to be building that brand now so that he stays relevant in 18 months' time, right? So he needs
indeed,
that marketing.
Indeed.
Sorry, I had a rant. Your rant.
No, it's good. It's I think you've said it very well, right? Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's actually quite the accomplishment when you think about it. It's like, you know, if someone had said, here, your task for the next 18 months is to suck all the cool out of this car brand. He would go, great. I know exactly how to do that, right? Yeah. I mean, all I need to do is be me. Yeah. I need to turn off marketing. Yeah. I need to not do any content. And I need to basically screw up my product launch with this, you know, fat DeLorean. And
fat
there
DeLorean.
You go. And now you've managed to suck all the cool out of this company. And that vacuum, to your very excellent point, it's not like there's nobody waiting in the wings to fill that void, right? I mean, you've got Rivian, you've got, you know, so many other cool EV companies that are ready to come in and go, oh, we'll take that. Yeah. We'll take that on.
Well,
and
what a great
example. And the thing is, he keeps saying that he's not a car company, right? He keeps saying, well, we're a software company, or we're an electrical Bullets. Company or whatever. And it's like, no, you're a car company. That's what you do. That's where your stock value is right now.
Hugely overvalued as a car company, as you say. But that's the other thing. Yeah. Like Rivian, I mean, probably because of where you are in California, I think they're a West Coast company, aren't they, Rivian?
They are indeed.
You probably know a bit more about the background and who the CEO is and that kind of stuff. But for me, I don't know any of that stuff, but they're fucking cool, right? And they don't even sell them here yet, right? And we already know about that coolness of that brand, and yet Tesla is now Elon Musk, and Elon Musk is most certainly not cool. So, yeah,
that's right. That's right. Yeah, they. I mean, they are cool. The people, you know, the general brand is considered. It's pretty niche, I would say. Yeah. You know, because their cars are so expensive.
Yes, absolutely.
The general public doesn't understand how cool they are, but that's the classic way to introduce a brand like Rivian is to make it exclusive and expensive and cool and aspirational, a luxury brand and all that kind of stuff. It's what Tesla was, right? And then the idea is it's classic marketing 101. You come out with a luxury brand, then you offer the discount brand at the, you know, for a discounted price. And people can now afford the luxury brand, right? Well, so you get all those aspirational people trying to upsell into what they want to be a part of. And, you know, this is every luxury brand's case study since the beginning of time.
Yes.
And Tesla has managed to absolutely screw that up.
Well, in a way, Rivian is following that model, right? Because Tesla, like you say, they brought out the expensive car first, which is exactly what Rivian have done. But now they're bringing out trucks in there. And the latest I read, which is, I think is the model they're going to start selling here in Europe, is a smaller little SUV that's probably, you know, it's not going to be in the budget. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be up there in terms of cost, but it's not going to be their most expensive model. And that's how they'll crack into Europe, a smaller car. And what'll, you know, and that brand air cover of being cool is going to help them, right? And Tesla are losing that.
I think that's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, we'll see. We will see if we get, you know, if they can do anything. I mean, they just announced earnings, and their earnings were not great.
No.
So we'll see if they can do anything. But meanwhile, what they're doing with marketing is just, I mean, from what I understand, there's still a small marketing team that is in Europe. They've ostensibly killed marketing for. Yeah. I mean, and the funny thing is that they. Even if there are still marketing people in Tesla, what they've now done is to say, don't pay attention to our marketing.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure. You know, in other words, they say what he's done is to actually, by throwing marketing under the bus in the way that he did, he not only threw the people that he's throwing out under the bus, he also threw anybody else that he's got in marketing there at Tesla under the bus as well, because what he's teaching us as consumers and as other colleagues in the profession. He's basically saying anything we do that is in marketing is average and awful. Yeah. So, you know, don't pay any attention to what we have to say.
Yeah. No. And just to mention that you wrote about this as well on CMI, and also your rant on This Old Marketing, your podcast with Joe Polizzi was great. And what I love about your position on this is as a paid up trade union member of the Marketers Club, right, is that what he's saying about marketing, which I don't think has been really picked up in the press. And also what you were saying about the fact that out of the however many thousands of people they're laying off, the 40 people they're laying off in marketing is actually making headlines. So can we take some solace from that? That marketing is actually important, that people have noticed that.
but the sad thing is, I mean, it's true. That we've noticed it, but the reason that we've noticed it is because we noticed it when they started doing some. You know what I mean? It was like
the
reason that it got any sort of traction at all was because, you know, because look, again, most of the mainstream media that is covering this is actually getting it wrong.
Yeah,
they're saying, well, this team has only been around for the last year. They haven't. They've been around for at least 5 years.
Yeah.
And so they've been working on content, you know, so if you go look at their YouTube channel, they get a lot of traction on their YouTube channel.
Yeah.
And they've got good content there. They've got a social media presence that's pretty robust in terms of the kind of original branded content. You know, it's mostly like videos of, you know, slick videos of the car and stuff like that. So it's, they're not, you know, they're long form advertising really more than anything, but they're good. It's good content, and they're getting views on it. I'm sure they're getting some brand lift out of it and all of that. But that, so they've been doing that since 2019 at least.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you go, the reason that they got any sort of attention at all was because Elon came out and said, okay, we're going to try some paid advertising.
Yeah.
That made headlines, of course, for the obvious reason that it made headlines. So the reason this makes headlines is because this is them killing that. And so the angle that most of those journalists and those magazines took was they're killing a thing that was only a year old.
Yeah.
When no, they're actually killing something that was 5 years old, but it was because of the year old thing that they did, which was try, quote unquote, try a little advertising begrudgingly.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's almost certain that that team wasn't the one that wasn't really equipped to create great brand advertising, because they're just not that kind of team.
Yeah.
And, and maybe they couldn't get things approved, or maybe a million other things that marketers struggle with every time. But the fact that it's news that these 40 people is one thing.
Yeah.
What makes it doubly sad is that he felt the need to go out of his way to explain why, when it clearly wasn't the reason. But his little man-child brain said, oh, I have to be right here. I have to be shown right that actually advertising wasn't the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to say basically it was average work and it could have been for any car company.
Yeah.
So therefore my team let me down, not that I made a decision that was wrong. Mm. And that's just the bothersome part.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I love your rant. I love your rant on this. And but where else can people find lovely rants from your good self?
Well, these days, so these days you can well, there's our podcast, which of course is This Old Marketing, and that's where I'm doing most of my ranting these days, but then of course there's our website, which is contentadvisory.net.
Splendid. And I'll also include some links in the show notes from what you just discussed. And also I thought that Alex Ingram post that he put on LinkedIn, who was the boss of this group that got all fired, was quite nice, as well as you observed as well. And also I'd encourage people to go look at your other stuff on this particular topic, because there's quite a lot of you've done the work, you've done the homework, you can see the work they've done. So I think that's great. And then when people spin the dial on the interwebs, where are they going to find you, mate?
They'll find me on LinkedIn. That's actually where I found Alex's post. And I went and looked for it to see if he had anything to say.
Yeah.
And he did.
Yeah.
I'm not connected with him. I don't know him at all, but I went and read his post, and it was a lovely post to his team. And basically thanking, it was a very gracious thanking Tesla for the time and basically saying good luck and God bless to everybody, and saying he was going to take some time off. And it was a typical sort of very gracious exit note.
Yeah.
But what I was struck by, the thing that I was struck by, was that it basically flew in the face of everything else that was getting reported, that he said, you know, we've been doing this great work for 5 years.
Plus we keep opening this wormhole again, rabbit hole and diving down into it. But I kind of was reading between the lines that it's been quite a ride for him. Like, various projects seem to be started and stopped, and it doesn't seem like it's been that smooth a ride for him at Tesla. So I bet he's got a book in him that'll be quite interesting to read about that time that he's with Tesla.
I saw that as well. I noticed that as well. Yeah, and I purposely didn't try to put any sort of innuendo in there. And so I didn't try to sort of interpret those tea leaves, but it didn't go unnoticed by me either.
Yeah. Splendid. Well, thank you, mate. But most importantly for me, I mean, if I could go back to the way that we segue into these things, will you be in the bar next week?
I will be.
Good. And I hope that we've all calmed down from this story by then. So I'll see you then. Cheers, buddy. Thank you, Robert. And that's what the virtual bar is for, an opportunity to get something off your chest in a safe place. I don't think we've heard the last of Musk versus marketing. So that's a wrap on episode 215 of the Rockstar CMO Effing Marketing Podcast. I've been your host, Ian Truscott. You can find links to me, Robert, and all the things we discussed in the show notes on rockstarcmo.com, along with our blog, newsletter, and all of our previous episodes. And thank you for dropping a dime into your podcasting jukebox, selecting our track, and jiving along with us. I'd love to hear from you, so please say hello, or drop us a rating or review in your favourite podcast app, or just keep listening. I'm glad you're here. Next week, more of the same with five effing thoughts from me, and Robert will be back in the virtual bar with his weekly marketing thought. Until then, have a great week, and I hope you can join us here next week on Rockstar CMO FM.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.